Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are discussing, chapter 16, and then we will be reading the first half of chapter 17. Just the first half, because let me have a quick count here of how many pages it is. It is 23 pages, I think, if I just counted correctly, which is just a bit long. All right, so I'm going to split it in half. We'll read the first 11 or so pages of that. I'll try to find a good moment to split it up as well. But first, the questions that I asked you about chapter 16 were these. So, Catherine was apparently rather heavily pregnant. Oh, discuss. Number two, she's also rather dead. Discuss this too. And number three, despite knowing she would give birth and die at some point in the novel, were these events a surprise to you? They were certainly a surprise to me, which is why I asked that question. And I wondered, alright, I know that this book hasn't been sinking in that well for me, and I've missed a few vital things, but, how did I miss that? And I know it was a couple of chapters ago that someone, I forget who, I apologize, mentioned that they thought she might be pregnant. Something that Nally said may have hinted that she was pregnant, that Catherine was pregnant. But it just took me as a surprise. I thought, well, maybe she is, but I didn't think she was far along enough to give birth. Anyway, Techrific came in with the vocab needed. Suffused means overspread so as to fill with a glow. Heterodox means not conforming with accepted views. Heterodox, I didn't know that one. Larches is a coniferous tree with bright green needles found in cool regions of the northern hemisphere. Ousels is birds that resemble the blackbird. Fain means compelled by the circumstances or obliged. Goaded means driven by a strong impulse. Interment means a burial. And bilberry means a hardy dwarf shrub with edible berries. All About Alice said, the only thing that was really surprising to me was Linton being buried on the moors with Catherine rather than in his family crypt. It's really like that last FU to Heathcliff, in my opinion. Edgar's love is so great that he would forgo all civility to be buried on a hill. He already gave Catherine her last wish to be wild and free, and then joins her despite his rather civil and reserved nature. Going back to yesterday's discussion a little, it was mentioned that Heathcliff won't forgive Catherine for killing herself, but in this chapter he's also going to go on without forgiving himself. Catherine Earnshaw, may you not rest as long as I am living. You said I killed you, haunt me then. The murdered do haunt their murderers, I believe. It's interesting, though, how this acceptance of blame is very selfish. He takes on the blame because he wants Catherine to stay with him even in death. He also replaces her locket of Linton's hair with his own. Does anyone else feel this is a very stalker-esque, where his obsession is more about himself than Catherine? I also appreciate the subtle action of wrapping Heathcliff and Linton's hair together into a locket. Nally could have cast Heathcliff's hair aside and replaced the locket with Linton's, or left it the way she found it, with just Heathcliff's. Despite contrasting feelings throughout her narrative, this little thing seems to show she believes that both people are important to Catherine, or that she respects the dual nature of Catherine. Techrific said, in response to Edgar's love being so great that he would forgo civility to be buried on the hill, I agree with this. Despite being reserved and behaving slightly cowardly at times, Edgar shows his true colours here, and I really like his gesture of burying Catherine so close to her beloved Moor. It shows his depth and sensibility. I like him. Yeah, he's one of the few characters in the book who has some redeeming qualities. JMama8779 said, I think it was mentioned a few chapters back in a subtle way that Linton now has a potential heir if the unborn is male. Also, J Mama said, I can't say I'm upset about her being dead. We knew previously that she was dead in the present time. Childbirth seemed a safe bet aside from her raving lunacy. Yeah. Well, we knew there was a mini Catherine, right? Which we would assume was hers. And we knew she was dead. But yeah, I don't know, it just snuck up on me. I didn't expect either of those things to happen in this chapter. Starfall 15 says, two chapters ago I asked the question whether she is pregnant. Ah, Starfall, it was you. Well done, you picked it. And this sub pointed to some hints concerning her condition. Still, I didn't realise she was 7 months pregnant. I thought, probably early stages. I am guessing that for an unmarried writer of that time, it was hard to mention anything related to marital relations in an obvious way. Even she chose for Heathcliff to not mention it. Knowing his spiteful ways, he would have thrown an insult or a biting barb. The way Bronte deals with death is very clear-cut. I suppose, since she lost most of her family in a very short time, she is familiar with its suddenness. Yes, I was surprised by how it was referred to the two of them in one small paragraph. Two big events in the story dealt with so summarily. All about Alice said, it struck me as well. I even started looking back at every time death was actually mentioned. A few chapters ago we had the first sentence, 100 words long, but when she mentions actual death, Emily just writes, and then they died. It's almost funny how little effort she puts into the expiration of a person. The details leading up to and after are extraordinary in the perspective that this is a telling of a retelling. As I'm writing this now, I'm thinking it could be a character trait of Mr. Lockwood. Anyway, all that to say, I agree that this must be ingrained in Emily, based on how she describes death. G.K. Hahn said, it was definitely a surprise. We knew that her death was coming, but I didn't imagine it would be right after childbirth. Now that I think about it, it's weird that I didn't see it coming. Isn't that great when something takes you by surprise and then in hindsight you feel like it was obvious? That's the mark of a good twist in a book. That, like if it's too out of left field, then you're like, well, yeah, no, I would have never seen that coming. But if it seems like, oh yeah, how did I miss that? Then you know the author has done the perfect sleight of hand there to misdirect you away from what was about to happen. Mango Mondo said, I can't wait to be back in the modern timeline and see what Lockwood does with all this information. He seemed enchanted by Catherine too, but I can't imagine he decides to throw in with this family after hearing this horror story. I loved that the maid wrapped the hairs of Heathcliff and Mr. Linton together in the locket. A very sweet moment in hell. In hell. Oh, damn. There's a twist to the end of that sentence. Sweet. I don't know, like... Yeah, I suppose it's sweet. God, is it? See, I feel the worst for Mr. Linton. That's who I feel the worst for. And so I don't think he would have wanted that to happen. Right? So I feel bad for him. But I suppose it is what Catherine would have wanted. And who cares what Heathcliff would have wanted? That guy's a bad person. Wasm said, I gotta say, I'd think a pregnancy in the third trimester would be quite apparent, and Nally would have mentioned it more directly, though perhaps the hints would have been more than enough to a contemporary reader. Yeah, I think they only ever sort of euphemistically hinted at things like that back then, so maybe they were more than enough. I'm curious to see what happens with the newly born Kathy from here up to the time Lockwood meets her. She's born 2 months early. I'm guessing her mother's sickness and poor eating wouldn't do her any good, and her father wanted a son. Doesn't sound like a great start. 2 months early is really early, especially back then, where they can't, you know, they don't have the technology to deal with any health issues that might arise from the premature birth. But apparently this baby survives, as evident by the beginning of the book. Savvy Kid said, this chapter took me by total surprise. I mean, of course I knew that she was going to die, but I did not think it would be this soon, and her being pregnant was a bigger surprise. I thought She would get a little better and then get pregnant and then die in childbirth. Now that's irrelevant. Lol. Also, the way that baby Catherine is described is very sad. She truly sounded unwanted, and it revealed how selfish Edgar really was in their relationship. But question, does Heathcliff know about baby Catherine? Man. Yeah, now you're making me think that Edgar was entirely selfish too. See, there's just no winners in this book. I'm just not rooting for anyone in this book. I suppose, like, I wish the best for little baby Catherine. And Lockwood, I mean, we don't know a whole lot about him, but I still feel like he's, for me, my main character, weirdly enough. Like, he's just really the vessel, the narrator, kind of the story. But I don't know why. I think it's just because he was introduced as the first main character that I just get stuck on that and I can't shift my focus to another one. Or it might be the structure of the story. I don't know. Anyway, I still kind of am rooting for him in some way. Alviak said, "This chapter made me feel as though I haven't been reading critically enough. I had no idea Catherine was pregnant. I'm just glad others were surprised as well." Yeah, I mean, the best we had was some people guessing at it, saying, you know, was it that? Was that what's going on? It was hinted at. But no one really knew. I don't think anyone here really knew that she was pregnant. So, yeah, don't feel like you weren't reading critically enough. I think that was probably the purpose of the text. That's what Bronte wanted to happen. All right. That's the chapter 16 discussion complete. This is something cool that happened today. I received in the mail the prototype copy of Live a Little by Aaron, young boy who I kind of mentored using my Launchpad small business that I run. I've told you the story about him. I met him when he was in primary school. He joined my after school club when he was in, you know, early high school, and now at the age of 15 I'm publishing his novel. Anyway, the paperback of that came in the mail. Now, it's a prototype, and to be honest, I was like 90% happy with it. But that's the reason you get the prototype, is so that you can fix it in time for the launch. But I don't know, it just made me really excited because it looks great. It looks like the whole interior is fine. I love everything inside the interior. It's just the cover was a few little things that I was like, oh yeah, I'm sorry, that was my computer beeping. I just want to adjust that ever so slightly. It's passable now. Like, it actually looks really good. But yeah. A little tinker that I wanted to do. Cause like, if I don't fix it, I'll want to fix it. For example, the blurb on the back was, like, it's readable and it looks kind of fine, but it's just a little bit too, like, delicate text. Like, I'd like it to be not bold, but a little bit stronger. So maybe I'll just make it slightly bigger or something like that. Anyway, oh, this is probably the most boring thing you've ever heard. I just wanted to, with the excitement of seeing and holding the real book in my hand, remind you guys that, you can pre-order it on Kindle as of now, if you're interested to buy it. It's a couple of dollars, I think it's $3.99 or something like that. If you go to upandupmedia.com.au/AaronHuggins, actually you don't need that slash Aaron Huggins, just go to upandupmedia.com.au and look for the link that says Live a Little, and that'll tell you how to pre-order a copy. You can also pre-order it in paperback, which I am still finalizing, but it is very, very close. It releases on the 23rd of March, so a little time up our sleeve there. That's going to be an exciting time too. We've got like a mini book tour that we're doing. We've got a couple of launch events. We've got a bookstore event. So Aaron's being interviewed in a bookshop, one of the big bookshops in the city. All kinds of cool stuff. So that's really exciting. It's a bit of an aside, but it's something I'm excited about in my life, in my kind of book world. So sharing it with you guys. All right, let's move forward. Let's read chapter 17. Half of it, at least. That Friday made the last of our fine days for a month. In the evening, the weather broke, the wind shifted from south to northeast and brought rain first and then sleet and snow. On the morrow, one could hardly imagine that there had been 3 weeks of summer. The primroses and crocuses were hidden under wintry drifts. The larks were silent. The young leaves of the early trees smitten and blackened, and dreary and chill and dismal that morrow did creep over. My master kept his room. I took possession of the lonely parlour, converting it into a nursery, and there I was, sitting with the moaning doll of a child laid on my knee, rocking it to and fro, and watching, meanwhile, the still-driving flakes build up the uncurtained window, when the door opened, and some person entered, out of breath and laughing. My anger was greater than my astonishment for a minute. I supposed it one of the maids, and I cried, "Have done, how dare you show your giddiness here? What would Mr. Linton say if he heard you?" "Excuse me," answered a familiar voice, "but I know Edgar is in bed, and I cannot stop myself." With that the speaker came forward to the fire, panting and holding her hand to the side. "I have run the whole way from Wuthering Heights," she continued after a pause, "except where I've flown. I couldn't count the number of falls I've had. Oh, I'm aching all over. Don't be alarmed. There shall be an explanation as soon as I can give it. Only just have the goodness to step out and order the carriage to take me on to Gimmerton, and tell a servant to seek up a few clothes in my wardrobe." The intruder was Mrs. Heathcliff. She certainly seemed in no laughing predicament. Her hair streamed on her shoulders, dripping with snow and water. She was dressed in the girlish dress she commonly wore, befitting her age more than her position, a low frock with short sleeves, and nothing on either head or neck. The frock was of light silk and clung to her with wet, and her feet were protected merely by thin slippers. Add to this a deep cut under one ear, which only the cold prevented from bleeding profusely, a white face scratched and bruised, and a frame hardly able to support itself through fatigue, and you may fancy my first fright was not much allayed when I had had leisure to examine her. "My dear young lady," I exclaimed, "I'll stir nowhere and hear nothing till you have removed every article of your clothes and put on dry things, and certainly you shall not go to Gimmerton tonight, so it is needless to order the carriage." "Certainly I shall," she said, "walking or riding, yet I've no objection to dress myself decently, and, ah, see how it flows down my neck now, the fire does make it smart." She insisted on my fulfilling her directions before she would let me touch her, and not till after the coachman had been instructed to get ready, and a maid set to pack up some necessary attire, did I obtain her consent for binding the wound and helping to change her garments. "Now, Alan," she said, when my task was finished, and she was seated in an easy chair on the hearth with a cup of tea before her, "you sit down opposite me and put poor Catherine's baby away. I don't like to see it. You mustn't think I care little for Catherine, because I behaved so foolishly on entering. I've cried, too, bitterly, yes, more than anyone else has reason to cry. We parted unreconciled, you remember, and I shan't forgive myself. But for all that, I was not going to sympathize with him, the brute beast. Oh, give me the poker. This is the last thing I have about me." She slipped the gold ring from her finger and threw it on the floor. "I'll smash it," she continued, striking it with coldish spite, "and then I'll burn it." And she took and dropped the misused article among the coals. "There, he shall buy another. If he gets me back again, he'd be capable of coming to seek me, to tease Edgar. I dare not stay, lest that notion should possess his wicked head. And besides, Edgar has not been kind, has he? And I won't come suing for his assistance, nor will I bring him into more trouble. Necessity compelled me to seek shelter here, though if I had not learned he was out of the way, I'd have halted at the kitchen, washed my face, warmed myself, got you to bring what I wanted, and departed again to anywhere out of the reach of my accursed, of that incarnate goblin. Ah, he was in such a fury. If he had caught me, it's a pity Earnshaw is not his match in strength. I wouldn't have run till I'd seen him all but demolished, had Hindley been able to do it." "Well, don't talk so fast, miss," I interrupted. "You'll disorder the handkerchief I have tied around your face, and make the cut bleed again. Drink your tea, take a breath, and give over laughing. Laughter is sadly out of place under this roof, and in your condition." "An undeniable truth," she replied. "Listen to that child. It maintains a constant wail. Send it out of my hearing for an hour. I shan't stay any longer." I rang the bell and committed it to a servant's care, and then I inquired what had urged her to escape from Wuthering Heights in such an unlikely plight, and where she meant to go, as she refused remaining with us. "I ought, and I wished to remain," answered she, "to cheer Edgar and to take care of the baby, for two things, and because the Grange is my right home. But I tell you, he wouldn't let me. Do you think he could bear to see me grow fat and merry? Could bear to think that we were tranquil and not resolve on poisoning our comfort? Now I have the satisfaction of being sure that he detests me to the point of its annoying him seriously to have me within earshot or eyesight. I notice, when I enter his presence, the muscles of his countenance and are involuntarily distorted into an expression of hatred, partly arising from his knowledge of the good causes I have to feel that sentiment for him, and partly from original aversion. It is strong enough to make me feel pretty certain that he would not chase me over England, supposing I contrived a clear escape, and therefore I must get quite away. I've recovered from my first desire to be killed by him. I'd rather he'd kill himself. He has extinguished my love effectually, and so I'm at ease. I can recollect yet how I loved him, and can dimly imagine that I could still be loving him if... No. Even if he had doted on me, the devilish nature would have revealed its existence somehow. Catherine had an awfully perverted taste to esteem him so dearly, knowing him so well. A monster. Would that he could be blotted out of creation and out of my memory. "Hush, hush, he's a human being," I said. "Be more charitable. There are worse men than he is yet." "He's not a human being," she retorted, "and he has no claim on my charity. I gave him my heart, and he took and pinched it to death and flung it back to me. People feel with their hearts, Helen, and since he has destroyed mine, I have not power to feel for him, and I would not, though he groaned from this to his dying day, and wept tears of blood for Catherine. No, indeed, I wouldn't." And here Isabella began to cry, but immediately dashing the water from her lashes, she recommenced. "You asked what has driven me to flight at last. I was compelled to attempt it because I had succeeded in rousing his rage a pitch above his malignity. Pulling out the nerves with red-hot pincers requires more coolness than knocking on the head. He was worked up to forget the fiendish prudence he boasted of and proceeded to murderous violence. I experienced pleasure in being able to exasperate him. The sense of pleasure woke my instinct of self-preservation, so I fairly broke free, and if ever I come into his hands again, he is welcome to a signal revenge. Yesterday, you know, Mr. Earnshaw should have been at the funeral. He kept himself sober for the purpose, tolerably sober, not going to bed mad at 6 o'clock and getting up drunk at 12. Consequently, he rose in suicidal low spirits, as fit for the church as for a dance, and instead he sat down by the fire and swallowed gin or brandy by tumblerfuls. Heathcliff, I shudder to name him, has been a stranger in the house from last Sunday till today. Whether the angels have fed him or his kin beneath, I cannot tell, but he has not eaten a meal with us for nearly a week. He has just come home at dawn and gone upstairs to his chamber, looking himself in as if anybody dreamt of coveting his company. There he has continued praying like a Methodist, only the deity he implored is senseless dust and ashes, and God, when addressed, was curiously confounded with his own black father. After concluding these precious orisons, and they lasted generally till he grew hoarse and his voice was strangled in his throat, he would be off again, always straight down to the Grange. I wonder Edgar did not send for a constable and give him into custody. For me, grieved as I was about Catherine, it was impossible to avoid regarding this season of deliverance from degrading oppression as a holiday. I recovered spirits sufficient to bear Joseph's eternal lectures without weeping, and to move up and down the house less with the foot of a frightened thief than formerly, and wouldn't think that I should cry at anything Joseph could say, but he and Harriton are detestable companions. I'd rather sit with Hindley and hear his awful talk than with to little Maester and his staunch supporter, that odious old man. When Heathcliff is in, I am often obliged to seek the kitchen and their society, or starve among the damp uninhabited chambers. When he is not, as was the case this week, I establish a table and a chair at one corner of the house fire, and never mind how Mr. Earnshaw may occupy himself, and he does not interfere with my arrangements. He is quieter now than he used to be, and, if no one provokes him, more sullen and depressed, and less furious. Joseph affirms he's sure he's an altered man, that the Lord has touched his heart and he is saved, so as by fire. I'm puzzled to detect signs of the favourable change, but it is not my business. Yester evening I sat in my nook, reading some old books till late on towards 12. It seemed so dismal to go upstairs with the wild snow blowing outside, and my thoughts continually reverting to the kirkyard and the new-made grave. I dared hardly lift my eyes from the page before me, that melancholy scene so instantly usurped its place. Hindley sat opposite, his head leant on his hand, perhaps meditating on that same subject. He had ceased drinking at a point below irrationality, and had neither stirred nor spoken during 2 or 3 hours. There was no sound through the house but the moaning wind, which shook the windows every now and then, the faint crackling of the coals, and the click of my snuffers as I removed, at intervals, the long wick of the candle. Harriton and Joseph were probably fast asleep in bed. It was very, very sad, and while I read I sighed, for it seemed as if all joy had vanished from the world, never to be restored. The doleful silence was broken at length by the sound of the kitchen latch. Heathcliff had returned from his watch earlier than usual, owing, I suppose, to the sudden storm. That entrance was fastened, and we heard him coming round to get in by the other. I rose with an irrepressible expression of what I felt on my lips, which induced my companion, who had been staring towards the door, to turn and look at me. "I'll keep him out 5 minutes," he exclaimed. "You won't object?" "No, you may keep him out the whole night for me," I answered. "Do put the key in the lock and draw the bolts." Earnshaw accomplished this ere his guest reached the front. He then came and brought his chair to the other side of my table, leaning over it and searching in my eyes for a sympathy with the burning hate that gleamed from his. As he both looked and felt like an assassin, he couldn't exactly find that, but he discovered enough to encourage him to speak. "You and I," he said, "have each a great debt to settle with the man out yonder. If we were neither of us cowards, we might combine to discharge it. Are you as soft as your brother? Are you willing to endure to the last, and not once attempt a repayment?" "I'm weary of enduring now," I replied, "and I'd be glad of a retaliation that wouldn't recoil on myself, but treachery and violence are spears pointed at both ends. They wound those who resort to them worse than their enemies." "Treachery and violence are a just return for treachery and violence," cried Hindley. "Mrs. Heathcliff, I'll ask you to do nothing but sit still and be dumb. Tell me now, can you?" "I'm sure you would have as much pleasure as I in witnessing the conclusion of the fiend's existence. He'll be your death unless you overreach him, and he'll be my ruin. Damn the hellish villain. He knocks at the door as if he were master here already. Promise to hold your tongue, and before that clock strikes, it wants 3 minutes of one, you're a free woman." He took the implements which I described to you in my letter from his breast, and would have turned down the candle. I snatched it away, however, and seized his arm. "I will not hold my tongue," I said. "You mustn't touch him. Let the door remain shut and be quiet." "No, I've formed my resolution, and by God I'll execute it," cried the desperate being. "I'll do you a kindness in spite of yourself and Harriton Justice, and you needn't trouble your head to screen me. Catherine is gone. Nobody alive would regret me or be ashamed, though I cut my throat this minute, and it's time to make an end." I might as well have struggled with a bear or reasoned with a lunatic. The only resource left me was to run to a lattice and warn his intended victim of the fate which awaited him. "You'd better seek shelter somewhere else tonight," I exclaimed, in Rather a triumphant tone, Mr. Earnshaw has a mind to shoot you if you persist in endeavouring to enter. You'd better open the door, you, he answered, addressing me by some elegant term that I don't care to repeat. I shall not meddle in the matter, I retorted again. Come in and get shot, if you please. I've done my duty. With that I shut the window and returned to my place by the fire, having too small a stock of hypocrisy at my command to pretend any anxiety for the danger that menaced him. Earnshaw swore passionately at me, affirming that I loved the villain yet, and calling me all sorts of names from the base spirit I evinced. And I, in my secret heart and conscience, never reproached me, thought what a blessing it would be for him should Heathcliff put him out of misery, and what a blessing for me should he send Heathcliff to his right abode. As I sat nursing these reflections, the casement behind me was banged onto the floor by a blow from the latter individual, and his black countenance looked blightingly through. The stanchions stood too close to suffer his shoulders to follow, and I smiled, exulting in my fancied security. His hair and clothes were whitened with snow, and his sharp cannibal teeth revealed by cold and wrath gleamed through the dark. Isabella, let me in, or I'll make you repent, he gurned, as Joseph called it. I cannot commit murder, I replied. Mr. Henley stands sentinel with a knife and loaded pistol. Let me in by the kitchen door, he said. Henley will be there before me, I answered, and that's a poor love of yours that cannot bear a shower of snow. We were left at peace in our beds as long as the summer moon shone, but the moment a blast of winter returns, you must run for shelter. Heathcliff, if I were you, I'd go stretch myself over her grave and die like a faithful dog. The world is surely not worth living in now, is it? You had distinctly impressed on me the idea that Catherine was the whole joy of your life. I can't imagine how you think of surviving her loss. He's there, is he? Exclaimed my companion, rushing to the gap. If I can get my arm out, I can hit him. I'm afraid, Alan, you'll set me down as really wicked, but you don't know all, so don't judge. I wouldn't have aided or abetted an attempt on even his life for anything. Wish that he were dead, I must, and therefore I was fearfully disappointed and unnerved by terror for the consequences of my taunting speech when he flung himself on Earnshaw's weapon and wrenched it from his grasp. The charge exploded, and the knife, in springing back, closed into its owner's wrist. Heathcliff pulled it away by main force, slitting up the flesh as it passed on, and thrust it dripping into his pocket. He then took a stone, struck down the division between two windows, and sprang in. His adversary had fallen senseless with excessive pain, and the flow of blood that gushed from an artery on a large vein. The ruffian kicked and trampled on him, and dashed his head repeatedly against the flags, holding me with one hand. Meantime, to prevent me summoning Joseph, he exerted preterhuman self-denial in abstaining from finishing him completely, but getting out of breath, he finally desisted and dragged the apparently inanimate body onto the settle. There he tore off the sleeve of Earnshaw's coat and bound up the wound with brutal roughness, spitting and cursing during the operation as energetically as he had kicked before. Being at liberty, I lost no time in seeking the old servant who, having gathered by degrees the purport of my hasty tale, hurried below, gasping as he descended the steps two at once. What is there to do now? What is there to do now? There's this to do, thundered Heathcliff, that your master's mad, and should he last another month, I'll have him to an asylum. And how the devil did you come to fasten me out, you toothless hound? Don't stand muttering and mumbling there. Come, I'm not going to nurse him. Wash that stuff away, and mind the sparks of your candle. It is more than half brandy. And so you've been murthering on him, exclaimed Joseph, lifting his head and eyes in horror. If I've a seed, a thought like this, may the Lord... Heathcliff gave him a push onto his knees in the middle of the blood, and flung a towel to him, but instead of proceeding to dry it up, he joined his hands and began a prayer which excited my laughter from its odd phraseology. I was in the condition of mind to be shocked at nothing In fact, I was as reckless as some malefactors show themselves at the foot of the gallows. "Oh, I forgot you," said the tyrant. "You shall do that. Down with you. And you can spy with him against me. Do you, viper? There, that is work fit for you." He shook me till my teeth rattled and pitched me beside Joseph, who steadily concluded his supplications, and then rose, vowing he would set off for the Grange directly. Mr. Linton was a magistrate, and though he had 50 wives dead, he should inquire into this. He was so obstinate in his resolution that Heathcliff deemed it expedient to compel from my lips a recapitulation of what had taken place, standing over me, heaving with malevolence, as I reluctantly delivered the account in answer to his questions. It required a great deal of labour to satisfy the old man that Heathcliff was not the aggressor, especially with my hearty wrung replies. However, Mr. Earnshaw soon convinced him that he was alive still. Joseph hastened to administer a dose of spirits, and by their succour his master presently regained motion and consciousness. Heathcliff, aware that his opponent was ignorant of the treatment received while insensible, called him deliriously intoxicated and said he should not notice his atrocious conduct further, but advised him to get to bed. To my joy he left us after giving this judicious counsel, and Hindley stretched himself on the hearthstone. I departed to my own room, marvelling that I had escaped so easily. All right, we are going to stop it there for today's reading. Seems like a good spot to stop. Oh my gosh, that was an event. A little action scene there for us. Very cool indeed. Thanks for listening today. Have your say, by the way, at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Did I say that right? Probably not. reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Let me know what you think of the first half of chapter 17. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.